When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Once again, our top story. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has been removed from power, and there are tanks now in the streets of Moscow. Vice President Gennady Yanayev says he has taken over as acting president as the head of state of a special state committee. You're watching live pictures from Moscow this morning.
Like a democracy, total technocracy panoptically stopping me from an option. Be enthrallingly exotic, biologically installed microrobotics. Peasants, farmers, and gopniks crushed by economics. Locked up, no lockpicks. Iron bars, iron curtains. Eyes on every person. Lies vie to verify the inversion. Freedom's future uncertain. Collective soul hurting. Censored sermons. Spiritual surgeons. Culture conversion. Total convergence. Quasi-insurgence. Paid to direct the divergence. Controlled chaos. Reaction solution. Global seance. Divided nation. Stress test or 5D. Chess, multi-nation mutation through regulation, manipulation, covert operations, fiscal frustrations, stolen donations. What a realization. Optimistic expectations, peaceful demonstrations won't shift the situation. Spoiled locations, royal ordered organizations organized. The activation of spies, third eyes gone blind from the sprays in the skies. Catch us in the rye in the space race lies. Five finger discount, digital demise. These are your words from the wise, words from the wise, words from the wise.
2021, where he basically said, look, the pandemic has totally transformed the world, and we have to, Russia has to completely rethink its economy. We have to go full digital, full automated, full AI. People should work from home. You know, we should have, like, he basically said, all the things that we had to do to fight the curve, we should just keep and just keep doing it, right? And that should be our future. And, you know, in the same article, he said, you know, how tragic it was that, you know, he just basically made the case, like, we should just do whatever the WHO says, we should do whatever the UN says, we got to transform our society, this is the future, and anyone who disagrees is a bad person. Like, that's basically what he said.
Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back again on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast, and with me today, joining us here on the show for the first time, a brand new guest for me, someone who just came across my radar thanks to a mutual friend. Shout out to our listener, Vlad, and he recommended today's guest, Riley Wagaman, formerly of Russia Today. He's got an excellent Substack that I will be linking in the description for folks to check out. But without further ado, Riley, welcome to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here today, sir. Tell us a little bit about what brings you here, and also, yeah, get right into how you ended up in Russia, because I'm sure it's an interesting story.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Mark. I'm really excited to talk with you, and shout out to Vlad. He's a great dude, and he helped make this happen. So I guess my story concerning my strange relationship with Russia began about a decade ago. At the time, I was actually living in Central Europe in the Czech Republic, and I just decided I needed a change in my life. And so, just on a whim, I decided to accept a job teaching English in the Republic of Bashkortostan, which is a federal subject of the Russian Federation. And probably you've never heard of Bashkortostan, and I assure you, at the time, I had also never heard of Bashkortostan, but it sounded like an interesting place to go, right? And so I guess that what made me maybe a little bit different than a lot of expats who end up in Russia is that I really didn't come to this country with any kind of, like, I wasn't that interested. Like, I mean, of course, I was curious about Russia, and I wanted to learn more about it, but I wasn't like I was a Russophile in the sense that, you know, I didn't hate Russia, but I didn't care. I was just, all right, I'll go to Bashkortostan and see what's up there, right? Let's see what's going on in Bashkortostan. And so I got there. I was like, wow, this is pretty wild. And this was in 2000. This was like 2013. This was, I guess, February 2013. And it's hard to imagine, but back then, actually, Russia really wasn't in the news that much. So this was a little bit before Maidan in Ukraine. So there's none of that. I got there just before the whole Edward Snowden thing, I believe, if I'm remembering this correctly. So that hadn't happened yet. And so Russia was just kind of this weird place out in the east somewhere they didn't hear a lot about. There was, you know, media, you know, Putin was considered this in the Western media. Putin often got bagged on, but it wasn't, we were nowhere at the level that we are today with the sort of hostilities between the, you know, the East and the West hostilities. And so I was just in Bashkortostan hanging out. And then when Maidan happened and, you know, the Crimea reunification, things started getting really crazy. All sorts of things started happening. And I basically decided, you know, I guess I'll head to Moscow and start writing. And I should add that before I came, you know, before I fled basically to Central Europe, I had worked in Washington, D.C. sort of as a political journalist slash blogger. And I could only do that for about a year before I became completely disgusted with everything, including myself, and decided I had to get out of the United States as soon as possible. I was just totally jaded at that point. Like, one year out of college, like, I can't even stay in this country anymore. Right. So, yeah. If you ever want, like, an education in how cynical and twisted the United States really is, just spend a year in Washington, D.C. among, like, congressional staffers, you know? That's the best education you'll ever get about how the United States works and what's really going on in this country. Yeah.
I think I've spent a total of a day in D.C. and yeah, it was bleak in some ways and also awe-inspiring in others. But I'm sure a year is more than enough. And to go all the way across the world to maybe you could say the total opposite of America in many ways, Russia, and at Bashkortostan, is that even close to what you said?
It was a good try.
Awesome.
Bashkortostan, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when Maidan happened, I mean, that's when things really started getting crazy. You had this massive sort of sanctions war. And so, yeah, I ended up basically relocating to Moscow, where I worked for a number of outlets, including Press TV, which is sort of like, it's like Iranian state television. It's like Iran's RT. And then later, I actually worked for RT for several years. And I wrote for other outlets as well while I was doing that little writing stint in Moscow. And the turning point for me, though, and so I should say that up to at that point in my sort of, you know, my time in Russia, I had reached this point where I felt that I was in a position where I felt that although I understood that there's a lot of nuance to Russia and that it wasn't heaven and it wasn't hell, but I felt that the problem was that the way that Russia was being represented in Western media was just, I mean, it was atrocious. It was comical. It was destructive, nonsensical. And so I decided, you know, I might as well use my, you know, in my situation to at least try to inject a little bit of sanity or balance into this madness. Mm. And I guess the turning point for me, though, was when the so-called pandemic happened. Right. March 2020, that fun time, those fun times for us all around the world. And I was absolutely shocked. You know, at that time, I really did feel that Russia was sort of on a separate trajectory, that it had, despite all the problems in this country, and there are many, that it wasn't taking orders from any sort of globalist organization, that it was doing its own thing. But I'm sorry, but the COVID nonsense just totally disproved this idea, because Russia did everything that the WHO said it should do. It did everything that the IMF said it should do. It did the lockdowns. It did compulsory vaccinations. I mean, we can even get into the vaccine that it used, Sputnik V, which is not what people think it is. It's pretty nasty stuff. And it was just a huge eye opener. And really just opened my eyes to this whole world where it became just blatantly obvious that Russia is in total lockstep with the UN agendas, you know, Agenda 2030, and, you know, the World Health Organization. Whatever they say, Russia will just do it without thinking. You know, there are still very senior and influential people in Russia who have very, very close ties to the World Economic Forum. And although this relationship has been formally severed, you know, after the special military operation in Ukraine, these guys are still doing exactly what Davos would advocate for. So there's, what's interesting is that although Russia is separated, they're still doing the same thing. Anyway, I'm sort of getting off on a tangent, but so at that point in my life, I was like, this sucks. I can't talk about the things I want to talk about. RT won't let me talk about the things I want to talk about. So I left RT. I went solo. I started writing on Substack. It's been quite an adventure. And basically, a few months after I started writing on Substack, I got a message from a reader who was an expat who has lived in Russia for about 20 years. And she suggested, you know, we should find some like-minded people and buy some property in rural Russia and just start doing our own thing, because, you know, the cities in Russia, like Moscow and St. Petersburg, are turning into digital gulags. I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. So we have a little setup in rural Novgorod Oblast. It's a region in Russia it's north of Moscow, but south of St. Petersburg. It's sort of hard to imagine geography of Russia. It's so huge. And I don't even know where half the things are in this country.
Oh, what's funny is I did manage to find Bashkortostan.
Bashkortostan.
Yeah, I did find it. And I don't want to go too far off on this tangent, but we might inevitably get here anyways. It's west of Tartarstan, aka Tartaria. So for all the Tartaria nuts out there,
there you go.
We might hit that honeypot at one point. But yeah, no, yeah. I hear you. If people think the 50 states of the United States are hard to remember, imagine trying to understand these federal subjects of Russia. I mean,
there's like 80, 85 of them now, I think, maybe more.
Right.
There's
huge chunky ones out in the east. And then as you get closer to Moscow, it's just like spider web. Yeah, it's crazy. It's very interesting. And I'm sure there's a rhyme and reason to, you know, all of it, with all the various ethnic groups that have just been lumped into this, you know, landmass that was once the Soviet Union. And I've heard you talk on other shows about how Russia is sort of no better than any of the other players on the global stage. I'm not surprised to hear that, but I've been like you, you know, not necessarily having strong feelings about Russia. As I was a teenager, I remember on TV occasionally you'd get like this stereotypic depiction of of a Russian kind of country bumpkin type, or like a very nationalistic type. But other than that, you're absolutely spot on. Until this whole Ukraine Russia situation, you hadn't really, I guess Trump, the Russian collusion, and then I guess those two were kind of paired together. But yeah, with Russia during the pandemic, I think myself naively can be included in that group of people who just assumed, oh, well, Russia and these other countries that are historically adversarial, maybe they're not drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak. Maybe they're giving their citizens something like, oh, hey, you know, let's just go along to get along, you know, take the, you know, saline shot and let's all pretend like we got COVID and move on. That doesn't seem to be the case at all, according to what I've heard you talk about. I want to get into that, but before we get into that, let's talk about Russia as a, you know, post-communist country. I mean, this is something that I think in America we kind of overlook, that Russia has this kind of grip over its citizens, even though it's not a communist country anymore. There's like this almost like a second phase of it with this technocracy that you described as a digital gulag, the way these cities are turning out to be. So do you think that that stems from that post-Soviet era when the West kind of made some inroads into Russia? Or is that more of like a Russians response? Like, well, you know, like the Cold War attitude of, well, we got to beat them at their own game. If they're surveilling their citizens, we have to surveil ours. We can't trust anyone. There might be spies, moles, etc.
Well, I mean, it's a tough question to answer, because maybe it depends on what specific, you know, what sort of policy we're talking about in a very specific way. But I guess what I would say is, you know, the reality is, although obviously now more than ever in the United States, this whole idea that you have, you know, civil liberties or a Bill of Rights. I mean, let's be honest here. You know, you don't have rights, you have privileges, right? And this is true in any country, but there is an expectation still in the United States that you have some sort of right to privacy or civil liberties. And I'm sure that over the next few years, they'll do whatever they can to, you know, disabuse ourselves of this expectation. But in Russia, you know, Russia historically, even before the Soviet Union, there was never really an expectation of having any rights at all. It's not a country that's really known for its civil liberties. And that's just a historical cultural reality. It's very much, it's traditionally been, you know, a top-down organized society. You know, you had like the Tsar, or then you had sort of a, you know, a lot of Russians still are very, you know, they're nostalgic for Stalin, because Stalin was like, you know, the strong man who did what he had to do to, you know, keep Russia strong and safe. And, you know, maybe he had to, you know, do some things that weren't so great, but you got to do what you got to do. And so it's just a different, I guess it's just a different way of thinking about where you fit in society and how society should be organized. So I think what you could say, though, is that what basically happened is, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia really was vulnerable because of its situation economically and culturally. I think it was vulnerable to, as a sort of testing ground for a lot of the stuff that, you know, we see in the West as well, right? So in a certain sense, I don't think it's surprising that you have the ability in this country where, for, you know, basically our oligarchic overlords to just move in and say, yeah, I want to test my, you know, facial recognition cameras. I want to try my, you know, digital IDs. I want to see if this works, if that works. And there's not a whole lot that you can do about it. The Russian Constitution, although it has certain guarantees, is also basically just ignored, just like it is in the United States in many ways. And again, it's like there's no, I think that Russians, in a way, I almost prefer it. I have to say this. It's strange to say that, but because there's really no expectation to be treated like a human, which is, that sounds crazy to say, but I mean it in a way like Russians don't think that their government really cares that much about them. And right. That's actually really refreshing, because in the United States, it's like, well, I'm a Democrat, and if the Republicans are in power, the Republicans are going to be very bad to us. And then, you know, if the Republicans are in power, oh, I'm a Democrat, and the Republicans are going to be very mean. But in Russia, it's like, yeah, the government sucks.
Right.
You know, and so you could just sit around the kitchen table and drink and be like, yeah, fuck these guys.
Right.
And no one loses their mind. Right. So,
well, and I have heard you say in a previous interview that this creates a sort of open atmosphere for wilder theories, which we love on this podcast, obviously. But yeah, that you mentioned that the average Russian citizen is much more likely than, let's say, average American to venture into like a conspiracy theory. You mentioned the whole Putin having multiple body doubles or clones is a popular one you've heard, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's remarkably popular. You'd be surprised. There are so many, Russians have so many theories about Putin and what's going on with him. And so that's also, it sort of plays into this larger thing that I try to express again and again in different ways on my blog, which is that in the West, the coverage of Russia, it's so black and white. It's either Putin is our savior or Putin is the next Hitler. And in Russia, it's like, man, Putin is a clone, or like Putin was like sent from outer space to, you know, make us give our natural resources to China, or, you know, like there's a thousand different theories. And it's not there's like a huge gray area. And a lot of Russians, you know, they're not necessarily, you know, begging. They're not huge Putin fans, but they're not necessarily 100% against him. There's a huge middle ground, and this is just never expressed or illustrated in the West, and it's really disappointing because the political banter in Russia is actually really interesting and fun, and it just never gets through. It's either Putin and Russia, Russia is this evil fascist state and Putin is Hitler, or Putin is like this brilliant 5D chess strategist who is going to liberate, the West right. from Satanism. Like, it's so comical. And Russians are way more laid back. Like, what I really find funny is sometimes I just get these really angry people in my blog, commenters being like, how could you say these terrible things by criticizing Putin for supporting the digital ruble? It's like, bro, no one in Russia would behave that way. Like, if I, Russians like, yeah, the digital ruble sucks, or like, oh, well, like, it's life. I guess we just have to keep going. Like, Westerners, disaffected Westerners get way more worked up about this stuff than Russians do, which is very, very interesting to me,
Well, and it seems like the norm is to be disaffected or disillusioned in Russia, whereas in America, people still have much of, like, a lot of their hopes still invested in the government and, maybe not the current party, but whatever their particular sway is. That's very fascinating. There's a channel that I watch often on YouTube called Bald and Bankrupt, and I encourage people to watch stuff like this because for me, it definitely shattered a lot of my preconceived notions about the rest of the world. Just seeing a guy, a normal British guy running around in Russia talking to different people and just getting like a good poll, so to speak, of what other people are like around the world. And you will hear stuff like that, these fun conspiracy theories and whatnot. He actually made headlines for going to this big giant space rocket that was decommissioned and just left somewhere in like Kazakhstan or somewhere. It's like, I forget the name for it, Cosmo Station 1 or something like that. And yeah, he got in trouble with the Kremlin for that, got in trouble with KGB or somebody. But yeah, this is something that I think people should take warmly and realize, yeah, we're not all that different, but it is kind of interesting to hear that take on it. Now, I guess my instinct with that first question, where maybe we can turn this conversation further, is like, seems like the Cold War was artificial in many ways. And I wonder, as somebody who's lived in Russia now for a while, like, do you hear these kind of things? Obviously, it was a very traumatic, oppressive time for the people who lived through it. In some ways, maybe it wasn't. Maybe that's just my own, propagandized vision of it from the West. But yeah, it is something that I'm curious about because, as you pointed out, like, they use these countries as testing grounds. We've talked about on the show recently how Jesuits and Rothschilds and other groups involved with the, royal families in England went to China and sort of sparked their Boxer Revolution by meddling in the country, and then the Chinese revolted, and then one thing led to another, and you have this Maoist revolution that some people suspect was maybe planned out by these groups in the West. So, are there similar thoughts there when it comes to Russia's own history? Are people unwilling to even talk about that part of their past, or do people talk about that kind of thing often?
Yeah, it's a huge, huge subject. I think a lot of Russians, again, the spectrum of ideas and views on this is, you can find all, both extremes here, where a lot of people are very nostalgic for the Soviet Union, think it was a great thing. Others think it was this horrible, basically Western imposed totalitarian system. Some, things in the middle. Russia, I mean, if we're talking about conspiracy theories, Russia is like a breeding ground for them. I mean, there's so much to Russia's just the recent history in the last 30, 40 years where, there's all sorts of ways where you can reinterpret, what you've been told about Russia and what actually happened behind the scenes. One thing that is really interesting that I think comes up more and more today is, have you heard of this theory of convergence? Where basically the idea was that the the long-term plan of, I guess, you know, our global space lizard overlords was to find a way to essentially, you know, merge the Soviet Union with the United States and create sort of a, you know, a complete one world government or one world system. And there's still a lot of discussion in Russia and elsewhere about, you know, how successful was this plan? Did it actually work? Is the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed because convergence was successful? They don't need the Soviet Union anymore, right? And there's even theories that guys like Putin are the reason why they are still, you know, what makes Putin tick is not that he's against the West, but because he feels like the Soviet Union got a bad deal in this convergence plan, that they want an equal seat at the you know, they want to be considered equals. They want a good seat at the globalist table. They feel like the West reneged on its deals, you know, took too much of the cake, you know, took a larger piece of the pie than they agreed upon. And that's what this is all about. All these conflicts now, it's about its inter-oligarchical feud about who gets the biggest slice at the, you know, the UN agenda table or whatever. And the convergence stuff is really interesting because I would even argue, I mean, it's just my humble opinion, I'd probably have to flesh it out in writing, that we probably are basically, convergence has been successful in so many ways because, you know, look, Russia is allegedly, we're told again and again that Russia is like the enemy of the West and that, you know, there's allegedly this East-West divide. You know, I live in a small village. The closest town is 30 kilometers away. There's no stores in my village. You go to the market 30 kilometers away, and you can buy a bag of Cheetos, you know? Like, and you know, Russia, even while the West is arming Ukraine, and even while there's a horrible slaughter going on in Ukraine, killing tens of thousands of Ukrainians and Russians, Russia is still paying the Ukrainian government to transit Russian gas to send to Europe, right? Right. Like Russia still sells uranium to the United States. There's still, it's like this whole, there's no, where's the actual separation, right? Like, where is the actual divide?
Right. Well, it's kind of like the whole Coca-Cola, Pepsi thing where like during exactly. World War II, was it? America was supplying the troops over here with Coca-Cola, and then Pepsi went around and sold soda to the Nazis. So it's like,
yeah, I think isn't that how Fanta was invented? I think, right. Fanta, yep. Was like the Nazi Germany Coca-Cola or whatever, you know. Yep.
Fanta was Pepsi's thing, and then, yeah, same thing during the Cold War. Pepsi was like the Russian. I don't know if you noticed this, but there might be more of a Pepsi presence in Russia than there is a Coke presence. Even, right, though they're both American companies, but Coke just takes this rap as like the American soda, whereas Pepsi's, right, like the Benedict Arnold going supplying the enemy.
So there's a funny sort of, you know, there's a more recent example of this, which is pretty funny. It's, you know, after the, you know, the SMO started, the most recent, you know, Ukraine's tragedy stuff happened in February 2022. A lot of alleged, you know, companies, Western corporations allegedly left Russia. And so one of them was McDonald's. And so instead of just like shutting down McDonald's fast food, which is terrible for everyone and should be, in my opinion, just be gotten rid of, you know, immediately, they just renamed McDonald's. So in Russia, it's called Tasty and that's it. And it's the same. It's McDonald's. It just has a different name now, you know. Tasty. And some, this is the best part too. There's also like, you know, all of these other fast food chains were supposed to leave Russia, like KFC. And so they also renamed KFC to something. I forget what it is now in Russia. But some of the KFC chains, they just like kept the name. They didn't even care. They're like, yeah, whatever. We'll just still call ourselves KFC. And so when you pull into Leningradsky Station in Moscow, which is one of the largest train stations in the country, like in Moscow, like your train pulls up and there's a giant KFC sign like right there. Like that's the first thing you see when you get into Moscow.
That's incredible.
Isn't that funny? It's like, damn, man.
Well, and I recently had a conversation with someone about Abraham Lincoln and the Knights of the Golden Circle. And within a week of that episode coming out, a friend did a show on his channel, Old World Florida, about the Knights of the Golden Circle possibly being like the inside reference with the whole KFC, KGC, KFC, and that there are these ties secretly to the fried chicken company and this, you know, Civil War era secret society. So wild to have that, you know, make its way all the way into beyond the Iron Gates, at least when they were still up. But yeah, that's really funny. And I imagine it's the same thing with, you know, not just global fast food companies, but, you know, spyware, the Windows, Apple, all this different, you know, these different big tech Silicon Valley type operations. How have they made their way into Russia? Does Russia just have their own like imitations of this, or are you guys using Mac and Windows and all that?
Yeah, I mean, iPhones are a status symbol here. Every young Russian wants an iPhone.
Right.
So, again, like, I really do feel like, and maybe it wasn't even a conspiracy, it just sort of happened naturally. This idea that if you allegedly have two poles, that eventually you'll find some, you know, middle ground or whatever, they'll converge naturally. Yeah, there's no, the reality, whether people want to admit it or not, is that Russia is not heading towards some sort of trad, conservative, distinct future that's separate from the rest of the world. The younger generations and even middle-aged Russians, they have the same priorities. They all want their BMWs. They want to take vacations in Turkey, or, you know, they want a second home in Europe. They would love that. In fact, most of Russia's leaders have second homes in Europe, which is maybe why the SMO is such a clusterfuck. And it's just there's no like ideological difference. There's no ideological difference between Russia and the West fundamentally. It's more socially conservative. That's true. But so, you know, there are many, many countries, even within NATO, that are drastically more socially conservative than the United States. Take like Poland, for example. So it's really bizarre why, you know, Russians and Ukrainians have to die and why we have to spend money in this stupid conflict when basically, in my opinion, convergence has already happened. We're all on the same page. We're all following the same globalist playbook. So why are we killing each other? It's a mystery.
Yeah, right. Well, and I don't think there's any doubts about that. And maybe the, you know, conflict, artificial as it may be, between Russia and, we'll call it maybe NATO, maybe that's to give this illusion so that Russia can make inroads into its other, well, more outwardly facing allies, BRICS, right? Do you think there's any part of this that's maybe a ploy to kind of get those other countries in lockstep, or are they already on board and on the same page?
Yeah, well, so BRICS is, it's such a bizarre phenomenon, BRICS, because it's spoken this way as if it represents some sort of unique alternative to the, you know, G7 or the G20 or basically any sort of Western-led, you know, economic order, geopolitical order. First of all, BRICS was invented by a Goldman Sachs analyst, right? And it's in my opinion, it's basically just a loose confederation of countries based on, it's basically a conference of countries, a little block of countries who are working together to make sure that they're following the same standards that are being peddled in the West, right? Like, make sure that everybody's doing their sustainable development stuff, meeting their climate change goals, making sure we get everyone tagged and ID'd. There's no fundamental, it offers no fundamental alternative to what the West is suggesting. And in many ways, I do think that it was designed to make sure that no one was left behind, right? Like everybody gets onto the globalist, you know, cattle wagon. And so, you know, when people talk about BRICS, like, oh man, like BRICS is going to change this. BRICS will fix this. Like, do you even know what BRICS is and what it does and what it can't do and what it promotes? I mean, it promotes everything that the G20 promotes. Like, just go down the press releases that it, you know, publishes every year when it meets, And it's the same word salad. It's the same bullshit. So I don't know why people are getting so excited about this. I don't even know why anyone should care. Like, I've never seen anyone get excited about the G20. Why should you get excited about BRICS? Like, they're saying the same things. So it's, again, I think, yeah, basically it's a way for underdeveloped economies to be pulled in to this larger globalist project.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors. And you can use the promo code CRAZY or a variation of that for each one of them. First and foremost, the Hit Kit, which you can put a lighter in the Hit Kit and then take a bunch of combustible material, something that you would want to keep dry, and put it in your Hit Kit. You can use it as a fire starter kit. So I know this ad is usually curtailed to the smokers and the stoners, but you guys have heard me talk about that enough, right? So for just the average Joe listening to the podcast who wants to support the podcast, and you know, maybe you're a healthy person who doesn't smoke, you know, you don't, you take pride in your health and you're not down with smoking. I respect it. If you have any need for starting a fire, and maybe you're worried about like your lighter getting wet or something, maybe you're going camping but you're also going to be near the water, or you're canoeing or kayaking as some leg of your journey to get to your campsite, well, the Hit Kit is the perfect addition to your camping EDC or your camping loadout. The Hit Kit is waterproof, it's windproof, so you can get a fire going in maybe windier conditions than you could if you just had the Bic in your hand cupping it, right? The Hit Kit, when the lighter's in the Hit Kit, it has like this lip on one side, so you can point that wherever the wind's coming from, hopefully, and then your hand on the other side, so now you have basically a complete chamber around the flame. So yeah, the Hit Kit's great for camping. I really gotta say, I mean, especially if you're a stoner who camps. So if you're smoking weed or you're smoking anything out on the trail, definitely get yourself a Hit Kit with the promo code CRAZY. The new Hit Kits are off the chain, literally on the chain too, because you can hook them up to a lapel, tie them to your backpack, tie them to your belt, loop, whatever. It's great. It's perfect for the summer, really, the fall, the winter. Especially the winter when everything gets snowy and wet, your hands are wet. Find the Hit Kit on Instagram at the Hit Kit or go to hitkit.us wherever you browse the web and use the promo code CRAZY. For our next sponsor, you're going to use the promo code CRAZY15. Big shout out to Brain Supreme. Thank you so much for supporting the show. If you're interested in microdosing, go over to brainsupreme.co now. And Adam Schell is the guy to talk to about microdosing. You can use Brain Supreme and in a healthy way, improve your cognition, performance, endurance, so many different benefits to microdosing. You really got to check it out. And if you haven't heard my interview with Adam Schell, well, guess what? It's right there waiting for you whenever you're done with this episode. Learn from him. BrainSupreme.co. Use the promo code CRAZY15 at checkout. And a big shout out to Isaac Lazell and the Oregonite. We'll be right back to this conversation with Riley Wagaman after a very quick break to our dynamic ads. Of course, if you don't want to hear any ads, folks, sign up on the Patreon or the Substack. You got a premium RSS feed, and that goes right into whatever app you prefer to listen to the podcast with. And like I said, we'll be right back after this quick break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right. Now, if all of these, you know, sort of groups of countries coming together to work on these agendas, this is all just sort of I don't know, stagecraft to give people this idea that we're living in a world where governments are, you know, working in their own independent interests. And but if this is the case that behind the scenes, you know, they're all sort of just working together, what's the real reason for this Ukraine-Russia conflict? Is it simply they want this land, or do you think it comes down to some larger implications? I mean, there has been the thought that Russia wants to have, you know, alliances along the Mediterranean. I know Ukraine doesn't necessarily have a shoreline there, but they've been connected to Syria, right? Which is on the Mediterranean. I'm curious, you know, that's kind of all I really know about Russia's geopolitical affairs is they have some alliances with Syria, but what's going on with Ukraine? What's the real reason for that? If they're all just sort of secretly behind the scenes on the same team, so to speak.
Well, look, I want to make clear, you know, I do think that at a very high level, basically everyone is promoting the same thing. Whether on the same team, I think of it more like there's different cartels, but they're all peddling the same drug. And so basically, again, it's just this sort of inter-oligarchic conflict where there's going to be disputes, there's going to be fights. But at this end of the day, you're a peasant, they're an oligarch, they're going to curb stomp you. And whether you want to be curb stomped with, you know, a NATO boot, or a BRICS boot or whatever, I guess, you know, if that's what you want to fight over, so be it. The situation in Ukraine, though, in my opinion, it's really hard to say what actually motivated it, because there are a lot of reasons to suspect that there is a certain level of coordination when it comes to how this conflict has played out, just because it's been executed in such a bizarre way by both sides, I would say. I think the reality, though, is whatever motivated it, I mean, basically, the Russian position, the official Russian position, is that, you know, they wanted to protect Donbass, which had been shelled and attacked periodically over the last 8 years or so. And it was about stopping NATO's eastward expansion. That's another reason that Putin gave. And basically this idea that Ukraine it should be sort of in Russia's orbit of influence, in that it was historically part of Russia. And in order for, you know, basically it was considered an existential threat by Moscow for Ukraine to either join NATO or receive closer military aid or cooperation with the West. Now, okay, that sounds nice. I mean, that sounds maybe believable on paper. The problem is that this conflict, if you just look at it objectively, has exacerbated all the problems that existed before it started. So if you want to talk about NATO expansion, NATO added 2 new members over the last, you know, 2.5 years, Finland and Sweden. If this is really a conflict about protecting Donbass, Donbass has been shelled regularly since the start of this war. Their entire villages that have been flattened. Not only has Donbass not been protected, but there are now regular attacks on what you might call mainland Russia, like in Belgorod, which is across the border from Ukraine. Attacks on Crimea, regular drone strikes actually on infrastructure around Russia. And it's just doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, how is this happening? And as I mentioned earlier, even while all this is happening, Russia is still paying Kiev to transit its oil to sell to the EU, which is supplying arms and assistance to Ukraine to attack Belgorod, to attack Russia, which was an unthinkable thing. It would be impossible to even fathom something that insane when I first got to Russia 10 years ago. And it's just, so at a certain point, okay, there seems to be some sort of, you know, it's not that Russia launched this SMO without giving any reason. It listed some reasons, and some of them actually sound pretty reasonable if you think about it. The problem is that the war has actually made all these problems worse. And I have a friend who said that Putin has accomplished everything he set out to prevent in Ukraine, which in my opinion is true. It's just, that's what has happened. That's what we are witnessing. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of people look at this, they want to choose a side and they want to say, for example, they don't like the Ukrainian government. They don't like Zelensky. Fine. I don't like Zelensky either. I think he's a coked out weirdo. And so they naturally, their sympathies are with Russia, which again, I mean, my sympathies are with Russia too. That doesn't change the fact, though, that this conflict has exacerbated all the problems that existed pre-February 22nd, 24th, 2022. And so one has to ask, like, what is this war being fought for? And what are the real, like, is Russia just totally incompetent? Like, isn't it supposed to have the second most powerful military in the world? Is it not able to use its political and economic, you know, power and influence to reach some sort of state and that is, you know, more acceptable? Like, you want, if you're going to start a war, the outcome should be more favorable than the conditions that existed before the war started, right? Otherwise, why launch the war? So either Russia has blundered into something really crazy. It could have been, a lot of people have speculated, maybe this is a sort of Saddam Hussein scenario. So imagine a situation like in the Gulf War where Saddam Hussein was allegedly told by Washington, yeah, you could go into Kuwait, like we won't intervene. And then Saddam's like, oh, okay, I'll do that. And then Washington's like, oh, psych, we're going in, we're going to depose you. Maybe it was something like that. But if it was, why would Putin believe Washington? Is he really that naive? I mean, maybe, because this guy's always talking about how he's constantly deceived. He's constantly led by the nose. So maybe that happened. Who knows? Maybe Washington gave guarantees that if Russia intervened in Ukraine, it wouldn't get involved. Maybe that's what happened. And then, you know, Russia got backstabbed. There are a lot of other possibilities here. But again, at the end of the day, I have to say, whatever motivated it and whatever comes next, I just find it very, very difficult to understand why this killing, this destruction is taking place when there just doesn't seem to be a good outcome for the average Russian and the average Ukrainian and the average American and the average European. Like, what are we actually getting out of this at the end of the day? I mean, Ukraine has been destroyed. You know, millions of Ukrainians have fled to other countries. You know, it's going to have huge demographic problems. Infrastructure has been destroyed. BlackRock and all these other creepy investment banks and hedge funds are going to come in and probably obtain assets for pennies on the dollar. At the same time, all sorts of, I mean, the conflict, no matter what people are telling you, maybe on, you know, these weird YouTube channels, the war has not been good for Russia and for Russians. It's basically been a huge cash cow for certain oligarchs who are receiving huge government contracts. But aside from that, it's pretty much a disaster. And again, for what? What is the end goal here? And maybe it's a way to usher in real technological and societal transformation, something that we saw in World War One, right? In World War One, people forget what basically was used as a way to, it was a financial, global financial reset. It destroyed a lot of, or I would say it reimagined society in the way that we viewed it. I mean, World War One was when, you know, women basically became consumers, right? All the men went off to war and sat in trenches and died. And then everything was marketed towards women who went out and shopping, and it was a great time and la, 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 la. Everyone got back. You know, the family union has been destroyed. And we could see something like, you know, maybe we're seeing something along these lines. And it's interesting, too, because actually this conflict does have many similarities to World War One in the sense that new technology is being used, drone warfare. People, again, are sitting in trenches waiting to die. Nobody really knows why they're fighting it at this point. And so if we, you know, we have, it seems like around the world, there's this idea that there's major changes coming in the near future. You know, this, you know, by 2030, that seems to be the big year that everyone is looking towards. And so maybe this war is part of this larger agenda where they're going to use it to force through these sweeping changes in the way that we think about, you know, our social contract with our governments, right? And so, you know, even in Russia, it's very apparent that major changes are coming. You know, the CBDC, the digital ruble, is basically being fast-tracked. We see huge, huge efforts being put into changing all aspects of society using AI and digitalization. And so, yeah, man, it's strange and troubling times for sure, and not just in Russia. And I think that, I guess that's the agenda. Whatever they're doing, it's probably not good.
Yeah, well, I think you gave a couple explanations that might just be what it chalks up to, because sometimes that is why they do these things, to make money, you know, and maybe the leaders that we think are having our best interests in mind are actually just, you know, saving face while behind the scenes they're, you know, giving in to the schemes of BlackRock and all these others. But yeah, it's troubling times for sure. I hope we don't see any conflict where you're at, where I'm at, where any of the listeners are at. It seems like it's isolated to that one region in Ukraine as it stands right now, but it definitely doesn't feel, you know, warm to see a country like Finland, which borders Russia, taking a stand with NATO, right? I mean, this seems like posturing. Have we seen anything else like that? I think you've also mentioned, not in this conversation, but in a previous interview, how we see Central Asian countries having sort of, people are fleeing. I don't know why. There's maybe conflicts there within certain countries, or reasons, economic reasons why people want to leave Central Asia and go to Russia right now. That we've seen sort of not necessarily a overt war tactic, but definitely a subversive war tactic to open up the borders. We see that happening here in America for sure. But what's going on with the borders in Russia? Is there strong border control, and are they purposefully letting these people in, you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a topic that you see very little coverage of in the West. So I think there's this perception that, you know, in the United States, it is unique with this, you know, open border policy. They're letting they're not letting their best in, as Orange Man would say, right? Or whatever. And, you know, the United States being flooded with immigrants, and this is a conscious effort to destabilize the United States and also across Europe, right? There was the migrant crisis that occurred after the Syria conflict kicked off. And it's obviously a real thing. But Russia has the same problem. Millions of people from Central Asia are basically able to enter Russia without any problems whatsoever. Many of them are allowed to actually apply for citizenship, I believe, because they're from former Soviet republics, either citizenship or residency. I mean, it's very, very easy for them, I guess is what I would say, to basically migrate here and set up shop. And I'm telling you honestly, this is truthfully, this phenomenon has accelerated exponentially over the last, I would say, pre-COVID. It really wasn't that noticeable. And now, for example, you know, I used to live in a town outside of Moscow, and I recently visited it after I hadn't been there in about a year and a half. And I can't describe to you the changes that I saw there. I mean, the place is now flooded with Uzbeks and Tajiks. It's like a totally different place. There's people wearing, you know, I even saw a few hijabs walking around, and it's very bizarre, and it's a very serious problem too, because a lot of these migrants don't want to actually integrate into Russian society. They don't actually speak Russian, or they speak it very poorly. Many of them are actually quite religious. There are constant, if you read Russian media, there are constant fights and all sorts of other problems between Russians and these Central Asians. There's regularly problems where, for example, you know, some wealthy Muslim businessman wants to build some mosque somewhere, and then there's like this huge protest. And I mean, like, this happens. There's media reports about it every day in Russia. And for some reason, it never gets really reported in any meaningful way in the West. But the same problems, the same migrant, you know, crisis situation that we see in the West is absolutely happening in Russia, and it's going to change Russia. You know, Russia is not going to be, it's going to be different in 10 years. Like the demographics of this country are going to change because the birth rate in Russia, just like in the rest of the world, is plummeting. Russians are not reproducing and they're basically dying out, and they're going to be replaced by Central Asian immigrants. Basically, that's that. If unless something radically changes, that's what's going to happen, you know, eventually. So it's not really that different than, you know, the horror stories that we hear in other parts of the world. And one can only assume that this must be, I mean, is it just pure coincidence that this is happening all over the world at the same time? I don't know, maybe, but it's not difficult to believe that this is part of a larger agenda.
Right. This convergence definitely feels like it has its own variations in both Russia and America. And hey, maybe, you know, spy v spy eventually morphed into, hey, why are we fighting? Let's just work together and make the entire world our playground, our kingdom, and bring it back to what, serfs in serfdom, right? That's the feudal lords, it seems like that's what we're returning to. Now, Russia definitely has a homogenous sort of identity, but it also is very multi-ethnic from its beginning, right? I mean, you have entirely unique groups of people out in like the Siberia area and the Ural Mountains and all these different areas, you know, completely different, unique people. So I wonder if it's almost like a mini globalism in that sense, you know, doing something like the Soviet Union project where you have all these various groups of people, like a globalism sort of test ground, as we were putting it earlier, where you have all these different people and they find, oh, okay, well, when we, you know, impose these new people here, right, you know, they over time they realize, oh, okay, this immigration thing is something we can manipulate to our advantage. And then it becomes a game of chess where we're just being used against each other as pawns, you know?
Yeah. And so, I mean, an example of this is, as I mentioned, you know, when I first got to Russia, I was in Bashkortostan. Bashkortostan is home of the ethnic Bashkirs, right? So I don't, at this point, I don't know if actually Bashkirs make up the majority of the population, but it's, I don't know, it has to be at least 30% are ethnic Bashkirs. You know, the same with Tataristan. It's where this the native land of the Tatars. They have their own languages. They have their own customs. They're part of the Russian Federation, but they are in many ways, you know, sort of a separate. They got their own little things going on. In fact, they're even. Yeah, I remember when I was in Bashkortostan, I was told that their universities, at least their state universities in Ufa, the capital, you know, they have. If you speak Bashkir or if you're Bashkir, you get, you know, sort of first priority for going to university there. Things like that. And It also brings up this idea. I think actually I sort of agree with you, if I understood you correctly, that, you know, keeping these different groups into one large, you know, container helps actually push through. You know, if you have one agenda, it's easier to, you know, bundle everyone together and make them follow the plan. And you saw that one of the most bizarre and unsettling things was during COVID. You really would think that in a country as large as Russia, that different regions of the country would take different, you know, so-called public health measures, right? That there would be some sort of variance. The reality, though, is that because Moscow is totally obedient to the World Health Organization, they basically forced every single federal subject to adopt more or less the exact same so-called public health measures. So almost every single region in Russia adopted some form of compulsory vaccination. For example, and this is even in really far, you know, Arctic Circle regions of the country or whatever, right? Yeah. Where there's nobody lives there, but they still have compulsory vaccine. It doesn't make any sense, right? And, you know, what ends up happening, of course, is that the federal government sets out the rules and then the regional leaders have to decide, well, okay, we got these directives from Moscow. How are we going to implement these directives without pissing everyone off? And so you might have had different levels of enforcement, but everybody was following the same rules, essentially, right? And so, you know, if we extrapolate on this idea, I think it does, you know, again, there's this idea, for example, that this war in Ukraine is about, they want to, you know, the West wants to do this balkanization of Russia, like break it apart. which is possible. But on another level, I think that actually the much more, you know, if I was sitting in, you know, my back room smoking a cigar working for the space lizards, I'd be like, no, we got to keep rushing together. So it'll just be easier to, you know, make sure that everyone is toeing the line, right? It's good to have this federation of these small little groups and regions because we want everyone to cattle tag their proles and, you know, impose their clot shots. And otherwise, it's going to get more, we might have some outliers, we might have some people who don't follow the rules. We can't have that. So in a way, if you think about it, Moscow, and I would say China as well, they're sort of the globalist enforcers of the East, right? Like, that's their neighborhood. They've got their own little street corner where they sit and they peddle their, you know, WHO directives and UN sustainable development goals. And that's their territory. But they're following the same rules, the same agenda that we see in other parts of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, you make a great point there. It's much easier to manage. You know, I guess in the United States, it'd be like if every city had the same powers that a state did, right? It'd be chaos, you know?
Right.
You have Houston and Dallas warring with each other. But anyways, yeah, it is interesting to look at it that way. And I think, you know, when we see what happened with the pandemic, and I mean, you could compare, I guess, remote parts of Russia, Siberia, and so on and so forth to, you know, some of the remote parts out here in the United States, the impression I got was the more remote you got, the less people participated. And maybe that has something to do with the sort of that patriotic, you know, my body, my choice, you know, as hypocritical as that sounds, because a lot of the people shouting my body, my choice do not respect patriotism. But either way, there was that instinct in a lot of people who have a more, I don't know, closer to the land mentality. But where I was surprised to see that not be the case was on Native American reservations, where historically they have 100 reasons to be skeptical of the government. But because of the situations most of the tribes have been pushed to with welfare and these different reservation programs and being basically tied into the federal government, they all, you know, got the shot. And that surprised me, considering, you know, how much I've learned about Native American history. I'm like, wouldn't these people be like the most skeptical of anything coming to them from the government? And yeah, I guess that was true in Russia with groups maybe that you wouldn't expect to have gotten the shot. Are there like clinics and things like that for, you know, groups that are really remote? Like, let's say those folks out in Siberia who still herd reindeer and whatnot, like, were they even pushed into this? I can't imagine, like, in America the same was true. I don't know that many Inuit got involved in that, but who knows? I didn't look into it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think back. It's been so long since I really, you know, spent a lot of time looking at the how the, you know, clot shots were distributed to each individual region. And again, I think that while all the rules, basically all regions adopted basically the same rules, but obviously enforcement varied widely. So in Moscow, they really went gung-ho. Probably in the more remote regions, it wasn't even that, you know, even if they wanted to enforce them, like, how can you when, you know, you have like five people for every, you know, 10,000 square miles or whatever. But look, the reality is, you know, these policies were absolutely, and on a large scale, they were actually enforced. Millions of Russians were forced to get the shot. I would say, though, that in general, as a general observation, I think that Russians were much more skeptical of these policies. Like, for example, you know, very, very few people actually followed social distancing rules. You know, you'd had like, you go to the market and they had the little tape being like, this is where you stand. Like, no one did any of that. And people will wear their masks under their chin. And there was even a very lively black market for vaccine certificates, right? The number one way that the vaccine mandates or directives were enforced was through employment. If you didn't get your shot, you were indefinitely suspended from work. Many Russians just went to their doctor, paid them 5,000 rubles, and got a vaccine certificate. So it's cool that you can still do that in Russia, right? People can still just sort of work out their own little arrangements to get around these insane government directives. The problem, of course, is that as Russia and the rest of the world becomes more digitalized, more AI operated, you know, basically more surveillance state, it's going to become more and more difficult to do these sorts of things. So it's going to be harder to bypass the rules. And I think that historically, Russia has always been a country. There's actually a famous saying by a famous Russian writer who basically said something to the, he said basically, you know, Russia has all these really strict laws, draconian laws. It's a good thing, though, that they're so rarely enforced. And in some ways, that's still true. You know, they pass really stupid and insane laws here. But generally speaking, it's pretty hard for the authorities to enforce them for a number of reasons. I would say one of them is government incompetence. And also it's because Russians just don't want any part of it, right? So that's one good thing about living here. Like when people talk about how, you know, great and anti-globalist the Russian government is, no, not really. The best thing about the Russian government is that it's not good at governing, you know? That's the best part about it.
Yeah, that's very funny. And I wonder if America will ever get to that point where you have people who are just like, screw it, I'm not participating, and good luck if they try to stop me. Because we have seen groups like that be made examples of, you know, they get made out to be, you know, these cults. I forget the gentleman's name, but he was out there, I think, in Nevada or California, maybe Idaho, somewhere out there, Texas, somewhere where they got a lot of range. And he got in a conflict with the federal government while Obama was president. And I think his name was Terry Bundy or something like that. And anyways, yeah, he got into a big conflict because he didn't want to pay these Bureau of Land Management people who were coming and trying to take land from him. So, you know, you see this kind of stuff going on, and the federal government tries to make an example of people with their media wing. And I'm curious, because there was a time in the country when people would go to RT News to get like maybe a different perspective than what the four main companies here in America are giving people. And with COVID, obviously, you told us, you know, earlier, one of the reasons you left RT is because they were not, you know, transparent, and they were following the agenda when it came to the plandemic, right? So It's sad to see that, but what do you make of, you know, the media in Russia? Is there any sort of, do people have that same sort of sense about the media the way they do with government, or is it more like, you know, harder to present kind of propaganda to people that are that sort of dubious or skeptical of these kind of things?
I think it's similar to the United States in the sense that I think actually maybe even the majority of Russians have totally checked out. They don't really follow the news that closely. They don't really have strong opinions. This is generally true, I would have to say. That being said, media is mostly, I mean, the major media companies, just like in the United States, are basically in service to the government. So they're either state controlled or they're, you know, they're basically just giving you the mainstream narratives of everything and not really doing their job, which is, you know, to question authority, question power, ask the difficult questions. The major outlets in Russia don't really do that. That being said, it is incorrect to say that there's no press freedom in Russia or that there's no independent media in Russia. There is actually quite a lot of it. A lot of it is on Telegram channels, which actually do an excellent job of just providing commentary, finding news, you know, little news morsels and expanding on them and actually giving them context and nuance. There are even certain outlets that I read regularly in Russia. These guys they operate from Russia. They write in Russian. I consider them to be, you know, basically they're patriotic sources from across the political spectrum too. I mean, some of them are more left leaning. Some of them are more, I guess, conservative. But these guys, you know, they do a pretty good job of just pointing out things are, you know, we got problems. Things are exactly as the government says they are. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's tough, though, because at the same time, just like it is everywhere else in the world, press freedom is totally arbitrary. So it's really hard to know what you can say, what you can't say, and whether or not you're going to get a knock at the door by the, you know, from the feds or the FSB or, you know, whatever they're doing in other countries. It's hard to know. It's hard to say, like, what are the rules anymore? Like, what are you allowed to say anymore? I don't know about you, but, you know, for example, I got kicked off of PayPal just for talking about COVID vaccines. Right. So it's like you never know what you're allowed to say at this point. That's been my experience. Like, there doesn't seem to be any actual rules. They just decide, yeah, this guy, it's time to pull the plug on this guy or this outlet, this person. But what's actually on this subject, though, it's quite interesting. The big news here in Russia is that they're slowly pulling the plug on YouTube, which, contrary to what you might think, actually was a major. There's actually a lot of pro-Russia content, pro-Russia, I would actually have to say, like, pro-government content on YouTube. A lot of also, you know, stuff that's published by Western propagandists against Russia. That's true as well. There's also a lot of independent analysts from Russia who take a much more critical look at all sides, who publish and have channels on YouTube. But basically what has happened is the Russian government decided that, well, there's many possibilities, but the Russian government claims that they're no longer able to, like, they asked Google to basically pay for the infrastructure, the IT infrastructure needed to maintain servers in Russia. Google refused to do that. So they're scaling back, you know, the processing speeds or whatever the correct terminology is on YouTube. And now it's basically, it's so slow that you can't use it on a desktop, although there are ways to work around it. And so, you know, is this about some feud with Google? Is this about, wait, we want to start, are we putting the boot down on YouTube? I don't know. But, you know, also, you know, like, stuff like Twitter and Facebook are still blocked in Russia, and you can get around it with a VPN. But yeah, the Russian government, the internet is quite restricted here in Russia, I have to say, in general. I mean, assuming, again, there are workarounds that are not that difficult. But yeah, you know, they don't like, just like any government in the world, they don't want people asking too many questions. They don't want people talking with other people in other countries to compare notes. It's, again, it's like no different than any other country in that respect.
Right. Yeah, it definitely feels like there are reasons for them to stay on YouTube, especially considering the Tucker Carlson interview that I watched not too long ago with Putin. I definitely was walking away from that feeling like, hey, this guy Putin, he's got some good ideas, or at least he, you know, and that, again, in hindsight, was like, oh, well, maybe I'm feeling that way because this guy is a KGB, you know, intelligence agent who's, you know, spent, you know, decades learning how to be this charismatic and present his case so well, right? So it definitely came across to me on multiple levels. But yeah, I wonder where they see themselves in this new landscape of social media. I do want to ask you about, you know, their steps towards a technocracy. I see you have a recent Substack post about Putin calling for the full-scale implementation of the digital ruble. The Bank of Russia's central bank digital currency has proven its efficiency and functionality. That's the title. So I definitely want to ask you about that. But since we're on the topic of, like, social media, you know, TikTok is kind of considered like a, I don't know, communist Chinese platform by a lot of Americans. Does it have that same disdain or I guess, you know, impression from Russians? Do they consider it like, oh, well, this is more aligned with us because we're more aligned with China? Or do they kind of have the same sense Americans do about TikTok?
You know, I mean, TikTok is also very popular in Russia. So is Instagram, which, by the way, is also banned. But again, you know, you can just use a VPN and get around that. Again, you know, just like with Americans or Europeans, I think it's fair to say that most people they're not really thinking in a political way, like, oh, TikTok is associated with China and this means X, X, and X, or this means I'm supporting that, or this means I'm resisting that. Kids like TikTok, right? Even adults like TikTok. People like Russians love going on Instagram and taking photos of their sushi and you know, filtering it in four different colors. And it's the same. It's the same thing that people around the world are doing. And I don't think there's not a lot of thinking involved here. It's just people on the internet looking for, you know, their little, you know, they want to stay entertained. They want their, you know, five upvotes, their thumbs up. They want to be validated just like everyone else in the world. It's a global phenomenon that right. Russia is absolutely part of, you know?
Well, and in that TikTok world for us conspiracy theorists, we've seen a particularly Russian theory kick off in a huge way. And this is kind of what I was leading you to, is like the whole Tartaria thing. I mentioned it earlier, but I think his name's Alexander Dugin. And a friend of mine actually interviewed him, a podcaster named Andreas Exertis, who interviewed him, I believe last year, it was pretty recently, but they talked about this whole Tartaria thing and how there's a sort of Russian identity wrapped into it, maybe a sort of jingoism, Russian jingoism about the rest of the world, it kind of claiming that this great empire was written out of history by all of the West. And I think where it gets sensational for me is when they say, oh, well, and also the political state buildings that we see all across America were built by this Tartarian nation, right? Like all these old stone buildings, they're all built by the Tartarians. Forget about the colonists, forget about the founding fathers. They are all just hijacker pirates. And I wonder, like, is this meant to be a sort of like East versus West conspiracy theory directed at America to be like, you know, I don't know, just another way to throw us off, like, because there is truth in it, and I'm sure it's Russian-centric, but I wonder even if Russians see it that way. Like, America, we've taken the Tartaria theory to a whole new level.
Yeah, actually, that's a great—I can't speak from personal experience about how Russians feel about the whole, you know, Tartaria meme. To be honest, I haven't had a conversation with a Russian about it, so that's something maybe I'll have to investigate.
It must not be that popular from Russians. Yeah. That's just maybe I'm biased and I want it to be that way, honestly, but that's just my suspicion, is that it's like inflated over here, but not really a thing over there, aside from maybe like a couple of these, I don't know, like Alexander Dugin types, like more scholarly types or people who have like a political reason to put this idea out there.
Yeah, look, I mean, Dugin is quite a character. I'm not a Dugin expert. I have a blog friend and colleague named, who goes by he writes under the moniker Rurik Skywalker, and you should definitely check him out and talk to him. He's a really interesting guy. Cool. He specializes in sort of the esoteric, you know, sides of Russia and all the weird cults and bizarre things going on behind the scenes. That's really his specialty, and he knows a lot more about Dugin. Personally, I think that Dugin is a grifter and is not to be trusted, but, you know, I encourage everyone who's actually interested in him to just dig deeper on him and, you know, come up with your own conclusions. So,
right. And any thoughts, I mean, given that you probably have been in the, what do you call it? The federal place of Tartaria or Tartarstan, is there any sort of monumental architecture there that's worth noting? I'm sure Russia has a lot of great architecture, but some of it is like more communist, brutalistic. That's kind of what the impression I get from the videos I see. But is there anything like that, that are these conspiracy theories maybe running with something here and running, making it bigger than it is?
Yeah, well, you know, I've spent a little bit of time in Tatarstan, and I've visited the capital, Kazan, which is an interesting city. It's very beautiful and clean and has a nice metro system, but there's nothing, I would say, unique or out of the ordinary about it.
Like,
and
there are a hidden free energy subway system or anything like that.
Right, like harnessing some space technology. Not that I know of. And, you know, there are archaeological sites around Tatarstan, but it's usually... It's like sort of old, you know, Islamic like structures and mosques and stuff like that. I haven't really, at least I'm not familiar of any sort of unexplained large mega, you know, monoliths or structures. But again, you know, this is not, maybe they have them. I'm not familiar with it though, to be honest. I haven't heard anything about it.
Well, to be fair, it's not exactly in your wheelhouse. So please, folks who are, you know, passionate about Tartaria, don't go attacking Riley here, because it's not what he writes about regularly. But I just can't help myself considering you're there in Russia. And I'm not against the theory. I find it really fascinating, and I'm grateful because it kind of encouraged me to look into the history of where I'm from here in New England. And there's tons of old buildings here that most people don't even know the history of. And so that got me off on my own journey. But as we sort of bring it back to, you know, Russia and the cryptocurrency topic that I mentioned earlier, you know, do you think that the same way that the pandemic brought us all into this situation where, you know, at least here in the States, like, you know, something like somebody going out and picking up your groceries for you and delivering them to your house wasn't really a thing for anybody unless they're above a certain like wealth or status, you know, but it became a very regular, normal thing very quickly. And because of that, you know, it affected a lot of small businesses, you know, the whole delivery services and whatnot. It affected some of the businesses that weren't involved, and a lot of businesses had to shut down. And a lot of people were thinking, okay, well, this was how they started to get rid of the companies that weren't going to play ball with this new digital currency. So now all the companies that are, you know, survived that, you know, artificial sort of economic destability or whatever you want to, however you would accurately phrase that, you know, did that same thing happen in Russia? And maybe that's why this CBDC has kind of kicked off a little faster over there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not, in fact, the Russian government. So, for example, Dmitry Medvedev, who, you know, former president, prime minister of Russia, and also, I guess now he's the deputy chairman of the National Security Council. He wrote this incredible article in, I think it was November 2021, where he basically said, look, the pandemic has totally transformed the world, and Russia has to completely rethink its economy. We have to go full digital, full automated, full AI. People should work from home. You know, we should have, like, it basically said all the things that we had to do to fight the virus or flatten the curve, we should just keep doing it, right? And that should be our future. And, you know, in the same article, he said, you know, how tragic it was that, you know, he just basically made the case, like, we should just do whatever the WHO says. We should do whatever the UN says. We got to transform our society. This is the future. And anyone who disagrees is a bad person. Like, that's basically what he said. And by the way, a lot of what he said that's what's happening now in Russia. It's really funny talking about, you know, people delivering your groceries. You know, in Russia, in the capital in Moscow, they have robots that will deliver, that will make deliveries for you. They have these little, like, you know, four-wheeled robots that will drive to your apartment and bring you food.
Like a Roomba.
It's really, huh? Yeah, like, yeah, exactly, like a Roomba, but it's like cleaning stuff, and like it brings you like your eggs and a carton of milk. And there was this incredible story. It was, I think, from maybe last winter, where so they have, you know, they have these robots, but they also have just normal human couriers, right? And a lot of these guys are immigrants, you know, from Central Asia, as we mentioned earlier, and, you know, they have their little backpacks and they're tromping through the snow, bringing you your McDonald's, you know, fast food order or whatever. And there was this incredible video where one of these Roomba robots delivering food got stuck in a snowbank, and then the courier comes up and helps it, like, oh, I'll help you, like, fellow food delivery robot comrade, and like gets it out of the snowbank and puts it back on the road and it zooms off. It was just like it was surreal, you know, and this was like a big thing. Like, oh, look at this act of kindness helping the delivery robot get out of the snowbank.
Yeah, that'd be like in Terminator if they were like helping the robots get John Connor, like they, right. You know, like human cops alongside. Yeah.
Yeah, dude, exactly. And so, no, it's absolutely a thing. I mean, not just remote education, but even remote healthcare is now a big thing in Russia. The Russian Ministry of Health wants to do internet checkups where you don't go to the doctor anymore. you do everything through the computer, and you might even have AI decide if you're healthy or not. Everything is being, in fact, when, you know, Russia recently had a so-called presidential election, putting scary quotes around that one. And after the election, the Russian government issued a sort of agenda for the coming, you know, few years. And basically at the top of their list was digitalization, like transforming Russia so that everything is done, you know, digitally and virtually. And so, again, if you are under the assumption that Russia is somehow resisting this push towards, the digital concentration camp, the digital gulag, you are sorely mistaken. It's Russia and China are leading the way on this one. And the perfect example of this is the digital ruble, the CBDC, which was first announced in autumn of 2020. So, again, right around the time when COVID, you know, when we were at peak COVID hysteria. And just like every other country in the world, you know, made this, it can't just be mere coincidence that basically every country in the world, every central bank in the world announced, oh yeah, we have this new technology, CBDC is going to be great, it's going to be convenient, it's going to be safe, it's going to be effective, just like our COVID shots, and we're going with this now. And the digital ruble is one of the most advanced CBDCs in the world right now. I think China's ahead. I think Nigeria or something, somewhere in Africa, they've already adopted it, but it's been a sort of a disaster. But the digital ruble has already gone through about a year of small scale testing, and about 2 weeks ago, Putin came out and said, we want the full implementation of the digital ruble. This is the same garbage that they're peddling everywhere else in the world. So it's completely controlled by the Bank of Russia, which is not controlled by the Russian government. It's a separate entity. It's controlled by this freak named Elvira Nebiolina, who was a former, she studied at Yale. She's a Yale World Fellow. It's a completely IMF obedient, globalist obedient structure, the Bank of Russia, just like every central bank in the world. This digital currency, which is going to be controlled by the Bank of Russia, you know, it's not a cryptocurrency. It's a centralized digital token that's programmable, completely traceable. You know, they can basically do whatever they want with this. And it's this new level of control that I don't think we understand just how dangerous this can become. You know, like if you have a currency where that can expire, for example, after a certain amount of time, or can be programmed so that you can only buy things on certain days, or it can be programmed where, you know, if you don't get your vaccine, your digital rubles don't work anymore. You know, the people, in fact, this is a great example of just how dangerous this stuff is. It was in, I think, the summer of 2021, there was this, it was this big conference, Cyber Polygon. It was this big security internet digital security conference held by the World Economic Forum, and it was co-hosted by Sberbank, which is run by this total, like this really, really spooky guy named Hermann Greff, who is a former board of trustees member of the World Economic Forum. This guy is involved in all sorts of creepy stuff. Anyway, at this conference, the Bank of Russia came and bragged about how the digital ruble, like it was promoting the digital ruble and said, oh yeah, it's going to be so great because parents can use it to make sure that their kids, for example, when they get their allowance every week, they get their 500, you know, digital rubles, that they can't buy candy with it, that they can only use the digital rubles for certain things. Oh yeah, I'm sure that you're introducing the digital rubles to help parents, you know, make sure that their kids are eating in a more healthy way. Like, I'm sure that's the reason. You know, it's like they've even openly acknowledged, you know, they claim that it's going to be voluntary, but, you know, they've already talked about how in the future they want to issue pensions using the digital ruble, which means that if you don't get a digital wallet and you don't accept your digital rubles, you don't get a pension anymore, you know, at the end of the day. And they say it's voluntary. Let me tell you something. Russia right now, it has an alternative system to Visa or MasterCard. It's called Mir. And if you're a state employee, you're basically required to use the Mir system in order to receive your salary. And of course, it's voluntary in the sense that if you don't want to use Mir, you just don't get paid, right? And I think it's blatantly obvious that this is the next step, the digital ruble, and it'll probably take 5 or 10 years, but that's where we're heading. And I think, you know, Russia should be not seen as, you know, these sort of policies, obviously not to be admired, but this should be an example to the rest of the world. Like, this is what's coming. This is what's coming for the rest of us, right? So that I think that's one reason why actually it is important for Westerners to, you know, think a little bit more critically about what's happening in the rest of the world, because maybe BRICS isn't your savior. Maybe BRICS is the example of what, you know, what these weirdos want to do to all of us.
Yeah, the 1984 model. Well, I appreciate the invitation. I definitely want to take you up on it. I've never left America, so that'd be one hell of a first destination out of America. Most people go to like Spain or France first. I'll go straight to Kurdistan or wherever you're at. No problem. I'd love to. And that sounds like a really fun time. So I appreciate it. And definitely we'll talk further about that. But for the folks tuning in right now, get in touch. If you are gung-ho about this, if you're feeling called to go to Russia, at the very least, Riley can possibly help you make some arrangements and all that, or set you in the right direction. At the very most, hey, maybe you'll hit it off and he'll invite you to his village. But check out edwardslobsquat.substack.com for more from our friend Riley here. Any other places where people can get info from you, social media and whatnot, places you'd like to promote beyond your Substack?
Substack is the best place. I have a Telegram, which you can find through my Substack on my about page. This cool. is also my email is listed there. So yeah, definitely hit up the Substack and all my contact information is there.
Rock on. I love it. This is awesome. It's so great to meet you, Riley. And again, big shout out to Vlad for setting this up. I got the email only a few days ago, and this is the synchronicity of the podcast. You know, things just transpire like this and really cool ways. So I hope the audience felt as stoked as I did for this conversation. And until next time, we'll catch you and immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are on another episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. I'm your host, Mystic Mark. And of course, you just heard a conversation with Riley Wagaman. What a great conversation. I really enjoyed speaking with Riley. Checked another country off the map. Now we've talked to somebody in Russia. I said I wanted to do that a few months ago. Look at that, folks. We manifested it. And here I am at 4 in the morning recording this because I just cannot give up. Okay, folks. You know, I was getting into the flow of creating this podcast with the old intros where I would just read. And some people actually really like those and want me to continue to do those. Don't worry, folks. I will. I will do those again in the future. But I'm telling you, there's something in my heart that's saying just keep rapping. And tonight, I didn't want to do it. I was just going to do a normal intro and move on and just maybe do it again the next episode or just wait till tomorrow. But I said, you know what? Let's just do it. Let's just freaking do it. Let's just keep going. Because how cool would that be if I said, you know what, I never rapped until 2 months ago, and now you can hear every single one of my raps that I've ever done. There's no practice ones that are hiding on my computer. You can see it all. So we'll see how good I get, and maybe, who knows, maybe I'll stop doing it. But I think the challenge is exciting, and I think if people don't like the rap, they can at least admire that I'm trying something new, putting my heart into it. Some people say I'm whispering. That's fine. I am in an apartment and I'm recording these basically between the hours of midnight and 3 a.m. So I don't know how thick my walls are. I don't know if my neighbors hate me. Who knows? But I was considering doing this somewhere else in the future, maybe in my car, if I could figure out a way to get the same sound quality from my car, because I do have a mobile setup now, but at least I'll be unrestricted in my, as far as volume goes from my car. You just might hear a ton of crickets and stuff. That's the only thing I'm worried about. It's going to be a bunch of like nature noise in the background. But anyways, enough about this, folks. I just wanted to motivate you all by just giving you a little look behind the scenes and say, you know, if you think these raps are, you know, maybe not the right thing for the show, let me know, because I need all the criticism I can get. You're not going to deter me, that's for sure, because I'm someone who's driven, and right now this is something I'm passionate about. So if you are critical of it, I welcome the criticism. Don't blast me publicly with like a negative review. That would suck. But if you have some critiques, hit me up in the comments. I would love to see that in the Instagram comments, or if you want to be more private, which is probably better, you can DM me on Twitter or on Instagram. My Twitter or X is MFTIC Podcast on X. So go and follow me there. Send me a DM. Instagram as well, at My Family Thinks I'm Crazy. So yeah, I don't know. I don't want to make the podcast too much about the raps, you know, but it is a fun thing. And I hope that eventually, if it doesn't suck, it'll bring new listeners into the show. Because that's the world we live in today, where people are very, I don't know, short attention span. At least the younger generation seem to be. So something like a 2-minute rap that gets someone thinking might draw them in further to investigate. Because that's something I've always wanted from the rappers I like. I've always wanted to see them go in depth with these ideas and write a book or, you know, do an interview. And some of them have and some of them do, but it is interesting to me. So anyways, enough about that. Riley Wagaman, great guest, very fascinating stuff. Politics is a little out of my wheelhouse, I gotta admit. I've been tuning out of all the politics stuff, so hopefully I didn't drop the ball too heavily with the whole Ukraine-Russia thing. I know that's not technically politics, I guess it's geopolitical, I don't know, geo-conflict, but it's really not in my wheelhouse. I just haven't been tuning into the news, so I don't know, maybe my questions weren't as precise as they could have been, but I did take some time to watch a couple of his previous interviews. He's also got a great Substack called EdwardSlobSquat.substack, I believe is the name of it, but I'll link it in the episode description. And yeah, Russia, very interesting place. Maybe not everyone's cup of tea as far as the topic goes. You know, we were sympathetic to Russia. I think we should be. I think we should be sympathetic to every country. You know, our governments do not represent our people when it comes to these higher level military actions. You know, very rarely do the common people get a say in these sorts of things. So I don't know. The whole grass is greener thing was fun too, because it's like, yeah, people always have this idea of like, oh, well, America stinks, let me go somewhere else. And this bro actually did that. And, you know, he hasn't had the easiest time, but it does seem like he's made a really cool life for himself over there. And maybe Russia's not as locked down as we think it is in some places. But who knows? You know, Riley did invite me to go visit him. So if I do travel to Russia, I will certainly be documenting whatever I can, you know, without putting myself on the radar, you know. But, of course, I definitely am thinking about going on adventures like that in the near future. But anyways, if you want to hear me expand on more stuff like this, do sign up on the Patreon or the Substack. This was also good. I might just give this to the Patreon and the Substack people. No, I'll let everybody listen to this part, because it's from the heart and it matters. And I want to connect with every single one of you. So if you do feel so inclined, send me a message. I will get back to you. But I hope the podcast is enough. I think it should be enough. But anyways, I thought I just heard something. That was weird. Maybe I am pissing off my neighbors. But anyways, yeah, that's all for today's episode with Riley Wagaman. Please do go and support him in his ventures as a journalist. It's not easy being an expat in any country, let alone a country that is currently going through a major conflict right now. So, yeah, much love and shout out to our friend Vlad, who hooked up the interview. Of course, we gave him 3 shout outs. This is your 3rd shout out, Vlad. Really appreciate you, brother. But anyways, enough about that. Support the show on Venmo at Mystic Mark. Thank you to Tanya, who sent in a big $70 donation this past week. And we had a ton of really nice 5-star ratings and reviews that I'm going to read in the next episode. I posted some of them to my Instagram story. So shout out to all the people who gave me a 5-star rating and review. in July and made some really nice comments about the rap intros. So another reason why I'm going to continue doing it. But if you sign up for the Patreon and the Substack, you might hear a full story on a reason why I almost stopped rapping altogether. So big dramatic cliffhanger there. For the Patreon Substack supporters, we did get some recent new Patreon and Substack supporters, so shout out to them, although they're not hearing this because they're listening to a premium RSS feed with no ads, no interruptions, and no promotion from me about signing up for anything at all. So if you like that, the grass is greener on that side of things, I guarantee. And with that, folks, thank you so much. I'll read those 5-star ratings and reviews next episode, so please get some in if you have never left one before, and I will read your 5-star rating. I only read 5-star ratings, but you could leave whatever type of rating you want. I'm not telling you what type of rating to leave. I'm just very selective of what I want to read on the show. So if you want to hear yourself, that's a hint, a little way to do that. I can't explicitly say that, though. I'm not explicitly saying that. But anyways, enough about that. Thank you so much, folks, and immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.